Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, ceasefire in Gaza, respite for those who survived Israel's onslaught, perhaps amid the ruins left behind by American bombs and missiles. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Israel's war on Gaza, after 15 months of bloodshed and destruction, is a numbers game. When it began following Hamas's October 7th, 2023 breakout from the besieged ghetto, Gaza's population stood at 2.3 million. Gaza's population is now a little bit smaller. The official death toll stands at 47,000, including 13,000 children. But at least 11,000 Gazans lie, unidentified and rotting, beneath the rubble. Over 1,000 were healthcare workers, 217 journalists. These numbers lowball the casualties in a war the world's top court ruled plausibly genocidal. A recent study published in the medical journal The Lancet estimates that between October 7, 2023 and June 30, 2024, over 64,000 died from traumatic injuries inflicted by U.S. bombs and missiles. Another Lancet study, published last summer, pegged deaths from both direct and indirect causes, such as war-related hunger and illness, at 186,000. Over 1,400 extended families have been wiped out entirely. Meanwhile, an estimated 110,000 Gazans have been injured, 1.9 million displaced, 90% of Gaza's population. Where they'll go, with a ceasefire now apparently in place, is anyone's guess. Over 400,000 of Gaza's homes have been damaged or destroyed in Israel's U.S. armed war of annihilation, 92% of Gaza's pre-war housing stock. With me to talk about the plight of Gaza's displaced people is Paola Gaviria Betancourt, special UN rapporteur on the human rights of internally displaced people. Late last year, Betancourt and 10 other independent human rights experts published a statement entitled, "Israel's assault on the foundations of international law must have consequences." The GPM reached Paola Gaviria Betancourt in Colombia. Gaza, little Gaza, this little enclave on the eastern end of the Mediterranean, which many have referred to interchangeably as an open-air prison or an open-air concentration camp, a ghetto. Before October 7th, there were 2.3 million Gazans in an enclave 360 square kilometers, and which is twice the size of Washington, D.C., with three times as many people in it. So really crowded, 2.3 million. And at this moment, 15 months into Israel's war on Gaza, almost all 90% of the population of Gaza is internally displaced. Talk about this. How many Gazans are now considered to be IDPs, internally displaced people?
Yes, you're right, David. It's about 90%. With the situation that they have been displaced more than once, because we have to remember that they've been moving around. Their displacement has been displacement from center Gaza to Rafah, from Rafah to the center of the enclave, then to the north. From the north, they have been ordered to evacuate, then they have to move again to the center. I mean, it's been moving around without any safety, protection, anywhere to go. And we said it since I was looking again back to the different statements that we have presented as special rapporteurs, and we said it since 13 October, like 6 days after the 7th of October, that these evacuation orders were illegal. People had no safe place to go, and they have been recurrently illegal. Because when these evacuation orders are out, they have to comply with some conditions regarding the international humanitarian law. One of them, they have to be temporary. And second, they have to be safe. All the corridor for the people to move, they have to be safe corridors. And then the places where they are evacuated to, the zones have to be safe zones as well. And none of this is happening in Gaza. We know it. We've seen it in all the media with all the coverage that the very brave journalists have made. So this has been a situation where, and this is why we presented this statement in the 30th of December, the protection of civilians has been zero. I mean, there has been no protection of civilians, which is the whole idea of the international humanitarian law and what a defense army should be doing and the obligation of the occupying power is in this situation.
Now, so there are two elements here. There's one, the orders to evacuate, and the second is Israel's obligation as an occupying power to protect those people. Let's look at this first things first. Israel has ordered them to evacuate, and it's of course claimed all along that this is an immensely humanitarian move on its part, actually getting them to evacuate so it doesn't have to kill civilians, because it doesn't want to kill civilians. It's not targeting civilians, of course. It's just targeting terrorists, it says. So it's telling the civilians to evacuate. But this is actually amounts to forcible transfer, doesn't it? And your statement says this, that it amounts to forcible transfer, which is it a crime against humanity, or is it a war? It was just a war crime, or is that a crime against humanity? Forcible transfer.
It is. It's very important that we are talking about this statement, because what we wanted to do here is to compile all the violations that we have seen throughout these 15 months, as you have said. So we have said that these different situations that have been happening amount to crimes against humanity and are war crimes. So in this case, we are seeing that these both situations are happening. And what we have seen in this forced displacement with the evacuations, without all the guarantees and conditions that have to be set, as we have seen, as we said in I think it's the 13th of December 2023 statement, that we said that it was inconceivable that more than half of the Gaza's population had to traverse to evacuate a war zone without the safety that had to be put in place, and that obviously the consequences for their humanitarian situation without the basic service, etc. And that amounted to a forcible transfer, that those evacuation orders were obviously war crimes. And more than this, what we were seeing, and now we conclude in the 15 months continuation of the evacuation orders and conduct, that we saw, and we said it at the end of December as well, 2023, that we were seeing here was an intention to move the population of Gaza definitely out of Gaza. So there was an intention behind, and this adds up to what the very courageous special rapporteur for the OPT has been saying recurrently in her reports, this can amount to genocide as well.
So here you say, it says the expert said, quote, "We are disturbed that this siege, coupled with expanding evacuation orders, appears intended to permanently displace the local population as a precursor to Gaza's annexation in further violation of international law."
Yes, thank you. Those are the exact words of the statement. Those are the exact words, yes.
Now, I mean, the conditions that displaced Gazans face, many of them having been displaced, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, those conditions that they are now living in range from the abysmal to the absolutely dreadful, hideous, appalling conditions. right? There's some families living in ruins of buildings, but, you know, you see the pictures and they've got fires going and they seem to be feeding themselves to the extent that they can. And then you've got pictures of people in tents, flooded tents on the beach under appalling, appalling conditions. Can you describe the range of conditions that Gazans now face who are now displaced? What are the conditions they face?
Yeah, the conditions are the complete destruction of the housing, for example. There's also a statement from the special rapporteur on the right to adequate housing, reporting on that. He calls it the domicide because there's no justification for attacking places where people live. And there has been, I forgot the exact percentage, but 80, 70% of destruction of housing. This adds up to the destruction of public infrastructure, the hospitals, the schools, the universities, the heritage, for example. There's also another statement from the special rapporteur on education. She talks also about the destruction of all the educational, cultural, and heritage that has been destroyed, all the institutions and cultural heritage. And I think we received today some pictures in the newspaper in Colombia today. Every day we receive pictures of the civilian infrastructure destroyed. So,
and I mean, are you receiving information not just through the media, but from human rights organizations, aid agencies that are actually in the field there? Like, I wanted to ask, what's the situation in Almawazi, just west of Rafah, where I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people are living in this tent encampment in the wintertime, and there's been flooding, the sanitation is non-existent, there's mud and feces and human wastes all over the place and insects and...
Yeah, we received that information on a current basis, and there's all that's why it's so important that the humanitarian aid and the flux of the humanitarian aid is recurrent, and that's another violation of the protection of civilians that we have recurrently spoken about. As you know, before the 7th of October, there were 500 trucks entering the enclave, and now we have none in some of the 15 months. We have some days that none have entered. So the access to humanitarian aid has also been a big problem. The access to health, the polio, for example, that started again, the difficulties to do the polio vaccination for the second time because of the continuous attacks to some of the camps. Because the camps where they are also with all these conditions that you're saying have been also attacked, no? And we have several communications also and statements on those attacks to these camps. So it's basically a situation where we have said there's zero protection for the civilians. There's zero protection for the children. Recently also the Human Rights Commission has said it in a recent pronunciation, I think it was November, October, but the food mandate, the right to food, special rapporteur said it, that there's also people with a lot of hunger and there's starvation in Gaza. There has been 5 children that have died of starvation. And when that happens, that you can say that there's starvation in Gaza. So that's the situation. Those are the conditions. And that's what has to be. If we are going to talk about if there's going to be a ceasefire, because that's another part of what we have to talk about, maybe that's what we are hoping for. And we wake up today with the news that's going forward, and we hope that goes forward in the right way. The reconstruction in Gaza, it's reconstruction of everything. There's a huge impoverishment in the enclave. There's a UNDP report that says that for 2025, the impoverishment in Gaza will be as much as 75% of the people of the poverty will be augmented to 75% or even more. So recovering a whole population and putting people back to their feet and putting all this infrastructure, and I'm not talking about the mental health impacts, because that's going to take decades to recover from. It's going to take a lot of time.
What's the infectious disease situation like in tent encampments like in Almawazi and in some of these other gatherings, huge gatherings of refugees living in the ruins and in their tents? And what's the infectious disease situation?
I don't have an updated report on that, but I remember last year from UNICEF information around children with cholera and the critical situation when the winter comes, long diseases that augment in this crisis where this non-communicable diseases augment. So I don't have the numbers now, but I remember from last year, those numbers were very critical, mainly amongst children younger than 5 years. And we had reports from UNICEF of children dying, newborns and children younger than five that were in the most risk ages for these diseases.
And there must be thousands of children in these refugee camps who have no parents. They're orphans. And I guess many of them have been taken up by family members or by others who are just caring for them, adults. But many of them are just totally by themselves, little kids looking after slightly younger kids. It's horrific.
Yes, and that's one thing. And that's the other situation is the situation of the children that are injured. So it's and the injured in general. So it's the children without parents and many children without a supporting network, because whole families that have been killed. You know, we hear information of children that have lost all the network, have lost their grandparents, their older siblings, and you have families. There's only one survivor, and that survivor is a child. And I was going to say also the situation of the injured. There's people that need physical rehabilitation and obviously mental rehabilitation. And I think that is going to take a lot of efforts. Children that not only have lost their parents, but have lost or their family members, but have lost their opportunity to go to school. For example, children that are not doing anything now, just staying in their tents and just like waiting for the next place to evacuate or the next attack. So that has a huge impact in the children's life that can last, obviously, for decades.
Now, of course, we've alluded to this before, but it is, as an occupying power in Gaza, it is Israel's obligation to care for, look after the interests and protect the civilians. That is its obligation. It's not the obligation of the international aid community or foreign aid donors. It's Israel's responsibility. But Israel is doing the exact opposite. It's targeting civilians. Do you think Israel is actually targeting civilians? And comment on that it is Israel's responsibility to look after the people that are suffering in the course of its supposed assault on Hamas.
Yes, I think that has been like one of misinterpretations of this situation. There's lack of understanding that this is an occupying power with responsibilities according to the international humanitarian law, according to different international human rights covenants and obligations for the occupying power. Israel has a different way of behaving in this case than the way it has been behaving.
They are a protected people. The people of Gaza and of the West Bank are a protected people under the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Yeah, that's the whole idea. So this has been completely the opposite. So they have to do not the minimum, they have to do the maximum in the sense of the protection that they have to give. And I've been reading lately some responses that they give to even reactions to this communication of the 30th of December. I've seen in the media reactions from different Israeli followers or whatever, and they say, even fact checkers, I've seen like fact checkers saying, no, you know, this press statement is wrong because Israel defense army was really protecting civilians because they gave them one day to evacuate, or they gave them the right information and places to go. Or,
I mean, no other country in the world does this. Only Israel. It warns civilians to get out before it bombs their neighborhoods.
Yeah. And they develop like an app, or they just, this is doing the minimum. This is doing the minimum, knowing that people, they don't have access to the internet. If it was going to be something that they did through the cell phone, this is giving information on places to go, knowing that in the way there, they had tanks and they had people that were going to put them at risk. And yeah, there's situations that have been reported in the different reports by the Commissioner of Inquiry, by different reports that have been out there, that they were not evacuated with safety. And the other condition of the evacuation orders to be legal is that people have to have the possibility to go back. They have to be temporary, and they have to be able to go back to the places of origin. And they, here, they don't have that possibility because everything has been destroyed. So that's the other factor. And they don't have anywhere to go back to.
Let's talk about this, because now there's this ceasefire arrangement apparently coming into effect, and it would be a three-stage, three-tiered ceasefire leading to the return of Gazans to their communities, like in northern Gaza. What do Gazans who are currently displaced have to return to?
They don't have anything. So I've been reading that they will offer some tents, some temporary housing, and but really they don't have anything. They don't have anything to go back to. And I have to say, obviously, if there's an agreement on a ceasefire, and it's an agreement that the people of Gaza agree to, and it's good for them, obviously we have to support. But we have to see this with a lot of care, because the reconstruction is not something that takes one day, 2 days. I was saying at the beginning that displacement becomes protracted. And sometimes when emergency happens, and people and humanitarians and governments are there in the emergency, sometimes when there's the need to plan for the long, medium and long term, so people can find real solutions that put them back to their feet, and they can regain their, would say, I wouldn't call the conditions of living in Gaza before normal, but let's say can go back to whatever was before. This first is going to take some time, and this is going to involve planning, and this is going to have to be on their, with their participation. And this is something that I have been calling for a lot. The reconstruction of Gaza has to be with them. And there's a saying with the refugees that has been there for some years, nothing about us without us. And I think this is very important. So yes, ceasefire, obviously, yes. Yes, returning home, yes. But returning to what and in what conditions and for how long? They cannot accept going back to tents and staying there where there's no water, there's no sanitation. As you were saying, the conditions of the contamination of the water. There's also a statement from the Special Rapporteur on water and sanitation, that the contamination of the water because of all the remnants of the
unexploded munitions all over the place.
I mean, there's a lot of contamination now there, the sanitation conditions. I mean, let's see if it's habitable. There's a lot of conditions there that have to be set in the ground before people can really live there and really plan to have a future. The condition for the food security, that's another one. And we have said it as well in the different reports.
I mean, really, in order for reconstruction to happen, rehabilitation, providing the aid and assistance to people to recover, understanding that it's going to take generations to recover, but forget about that, just recovering over the next couple of years, 5 to 10 years, and rebuilding, it's going to require an end to Israel's occupation. because none of that's going to happen if Israel is still an occupying power and considered by countries like the United States to be effectively sovereign in Gaza, because that's the way the United States treats Israel and its relationship with Gaza, that effectively Israel is sovereign in Gaza. It can do anything it wishes. And so that's got to end, doesn't it?
That's the first step, David. That's the first step. And I'm talking about this reconstruction under the condition that Israel complies with the order given by the International Court of Justice that recognized the unlawfulness of the Israel occupation and order the exit of Israel of the enclave and order also the reparation of the Palestinian people. I mean, there's an order here from the International Court of Justice that has to be put into place. So yes, if there's going to be reconstruction with the occupying power unlawfully occupying the enclave, that's a big question. I mean, are you going to be rebuilding hospitals, rebuilding the roads in a place that you are unlawfully occupying? That's a big question. You know, that's the first step that has to be solved. And I haven't looked into the three steps of the negotiation process, but doesn't seem, I mean, I haven't seen that there's a compliance with the order of the Court of Justice. So yes, that's another thing that we have to see what's going to happen with that.
The title of the statement that you and 10 other special rapporteurs authored, Paolo Gaviria Betancourt, the title, Israel's Assault on the Foundations of International Law Must Have Consequences. So what you're saying is that this isn't simply a war of self-defense, as Israel and the United States say, to defend itself against terrorists. It's actually an assault on the foundations of international law. Israel is attacking international law. Is this what you're trying to say? Israel's assault on the foundations of international law must have consequences.
Yeah, that's what we definitely are trying to say and try to exemplify with the continuing paragraphs of the statement. What I wanted to do with this was try to capture, as I said at the beginning, the 15 months of the violation of the international law and try to exemplify, which are not all of them, because there's 10 or 12 that are hyperlinked, but we have presented around 70, 75 statements, and the different special rapporteurs, rapporteur for OPT, food, freedom of expression, those are the ones I remember, have presented reports to the General Assembly or to the Human Rights Council around this situation in particular, or around the occupation of Israel and its impact. So yes, what we try to do was to exemplify this breach of the international law by Israel, the decisions that have already been taken by the International Court of Justice, the decisions taken by the General Assembly, by the different international organs that are out there that have been completely breached by Israel.
And none of you folks are allowed to go into Israel. There hasn't been a special rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied territories who's been able to get into Israel since, I think it was John Dugard way back when. And, you know, Francesca Albanese is not allowed in. The special investigating committee members of the Pillay Commission, they can't get in, right? I mean, you know, the Secretary General of the United Nations has been banned. And so can any of these things be achieved as long as all of you folks, the people who are tasked with caring for and commenting on and defending human rights, can actually get into Israel?
No, as you're right, we can't. And there's a big point that you're making there of what we were talking before about the if there's a ceasefire and this plan goes ahead, this reconstruction needs to have a monitoring agency or a monitoring body behind that seeks to also protect the people in its dignity and its will. So I think that has to be something also that it's agreed upon in these discussions. There has to be the possibility of a UN actor to be present in that process, because yes, there hasn't been that possibility in the past years. And I would say that's why the presence of other actors has been so relevant. The presence, obviously, of journalists, the presence of human rights actors, the presence of humanitarians, and obviously the presence of UNRWA. That is also another